This lecture is brought to you by the Orsemer Tape Library. The cassette library offers a wide range of lecturers and topics. For details, contact the Orsemer Tape Library branch nearest you.
Thank you. I want to welcome all of you to Eretz Yisrael. Excuse my looking a bit disheveled. Three of our four suitcases were lost in the airport, so I basically am stuck wearing what I'm wearing. But Amir Tashem, hopefully that'll be found as well. I understand the program's been underway for a few days, and unfortunately I wasn't able to join you for the beginning, but I'm really very pleased to be here for the remainder of the program. And as Rabbi Geffen said, if there's any way I could assist any of you individually or collectively, I'm certainly really at your service. I live right across the street in 50 Arzei Habira, and I'll try to be around quite a lot. The subjects of this series of shiurim, these series of talks, are some contemporary halachic issues as they deal with modern problems such as right to die, birth control, land for peace, various technological problems, maybe some genetic engineering, and the like. But before we begin consideration of a specific issue, I think it'll be helpful at least to talk a little bit about the structure of the oral law and the halachic process, so you'll understand, number one, the sources which we look at in trying to formulate questions. For example, you open up the Talmud is not going to contain any specific reference to splitting the atom and the like, or it won't even talk about microwave ovens. However, we try to look at the classical sources for principles, and the principles are eternal, although the application of those principles in particular cases will vary from generation to generation. It's not the Torah that changes. The Torah does not change. When God gave the Torah, God, as it were, knew the future. God, as it were, knew there would be splitting of the atoms, there would be fusion, there would be fission, there would be microwave ovens, there would be electricity. And God laid down a set of principles from which we can certainly answer all of these questions, but it's kind of complicated because the Talmud doesn't talk about the things that we're familiar with, and therefore it's important to get a sense of the sources, what we look at, as it were, authority, etc. A lot of this, I'm sure you will hear in other lectures as well. I think Rabbi Gottlieb and Rabbi Cardozo will be giving you a much more extensive treatments of the oral law. But I think it is important that at least I set out some of the basics before I get into specific issues. We know, of course, that every Jew that believes that God gave the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai believes that the Torah that God gave to Moses consisted of two parts. There is what we call the Torah Shebichsav. There is what we call the written Torah, which are the words of the Torah that are actually written down. They are in the five books of Moses. But in addition, Moses was given by God some supplementary interpretations of many provisions of the Torah, which for many hundreds of years were not written down at all. And that is called the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law. So we have the written law and the oral law. Examples of things, in fact, the truth of the matter is, the oral law to some extent predated the written law, because we know that according to some traditions, Moses did not write down the Torah till the end of 40 years, which means only right before his death he wrote down the whole Torah. So what happened for the 40 years that the Jewish people were wandering in the desert? The answer is, for those 40 years, what is now the written Torah was in fact the oral Torah. So in fact, the notion of an oral tradition even predated the written tradition. And the truth is, the written Torah itself makes reference to an oral tradition. It says in the book of Devarim, when Hashem gives Moshe the commandment of shechita, of slaughtering animals, he tells Moshe, v'zavachta, you should slaughter animals, kasher tzivitzicha, as I have commanded you. Well, that sounds great. Problem is, there was no earlier place where this was ever commanded. This is the first place in the Torah where Moses is told about slaughtering animals, other than for karbanot, other than for sacrifices. So how can God say you should slaughter in the manner that I've commanded you? The answer is that the command must have been the Torah Shebal Peh. The need for supplementary oral interpretation is self-evident if anybody ever considers the limitations of a written text. The Torah says don't do work on Shabbos. It says that, don't do work. Well, what's work? I might think not doing work means don't go to my job. I can go to the movies or go to the beach and the like, and I'm not doing work. And of course, the concept of work on Shabbos has nothing to do with physical labor. The law is that within this room, I am permitted to carry a 10,000-pound weight if I'm strong enough, and if I carry a paper clip from inside the house to outside the house, I've done a malacha. Or switching on an electric light is forbidden. Well, what type of work is that? Obviously, the definition of work, what is labor, and the distinction between malacha, which is the technical concept of work, and physical exertion, is something that is not evident from the written Torah. The written Torah is like a monarch's notes or a cliff's notes. I'm sure none of you probably had to do that in high school. But for us lesser people, we occasionally would resort to kind of canned summaries. And indeed, even in law school, where you figure people are more sophisticated, there's a huge industry in writing summaries of all sorts of things. And the written law, in effect, is a summary, an outline, which is supposed to jog the memory of somebody to be able to bring together all of the oral commentaries. Tefillin. The Torah says, what does the Torah say about tefillin? The Torah says you should put a sign upon your arm, and totafos, which is translated as phylacteries, whatever on earth that means, phylacteries between your eyes. How do you know tefillin are black? Doesn't say. How do you know tefillin are square? It doesn't say. How do you know tefillin have straps? Doesn't say. How do you know tefillin are leather? Doesn't say. None of this is in the written law. If all you were to have is a written text, it's not a question of the rabbis changing anything. You literally would not know what on earth this means. Third example. The Torah says on Sukkot, we take the fruit of a beautiful tree, pre-Eitz Hadar. What is a fruit of a beautiful tree? Well, we know that it's an esrog. How do I know it's an esrog? Because that's what my father took. That's what my teacher took. How did he know? He saw it. But the Torah does not say what it is. Fruit of a beautiful tree could be an apple, could be a watermelon, could be a papaya. What's a beautiful tree? Nobody knows. The answer is there must have been some oral interpretation to define those words. Otherwise, it wouldn't make any sense at all. So the point is, it is fairly clear that the Torah itself is deliberately ambiguous, unclear, obscure, to bring out to us the need that there must, in fact, be some type of oral tradition of Torah Shebal Peh. And indeed, the truth of the matter is, if you think about it, you know, we've had movements which deny the Torah Shebal Peh. They only accept the written law. The most famous of these are the Sadducees, or the Tzedukim, which were in Talmudic times. And in later days, we had the Karaites. Karaites comes from the word kara, which is a pasuk, a verse. They only accept the written law. They don't accept the oral law. But you know, it's very interesting that even the Karaites discovered that eventually they have to come up with an oral law of their own. It's very interesting. In Harvard University Library, the Widener Library, I don't know if any of you have been there, it's a huge, huge library. It's the largest university library in the world, and second only to the Library of Congress in total holdings. And they have a huge Judaica section, all sorts of Svarim. And I once came across a Karaite sitter. All right. Now, a Karaite sitter will, of course, contain the Shema, because the Shema is from the written Torah. That's in the Bible. But the Karaite sitter will not contain, and does not contain, the Shemona Esrei, the 18 benedictions, because that is a later rabbinic formulation, and they don't believe in the oral law. Right. So you figure the Karaite sitter should only have the Shema. But no. I'm sorry.
No, I don't want to interrupt. But yeah. Isn't there a distinction between the oral tradition and the rabbinical decrees?
I mean, I'll discuss that. That's a very good point. You're correct. Technically speaking, the Shemona Esrei is not part of the oral law transmitted to Moshe. It's later rabbinic. But the Tzedukim and the Karaites deny both components of that tradition. They deny one as well as the other. But you're correct. My example is technically off the particular point that I'm making. But it is interesting that everybody needs an oral tradition. So I thought the Karaites wouldn't have a Shemona Esrei, and I was right. But instead, they had all of these long, long prayers that they had written on their own. In other words, over the course of hundreds of years, they developed their own oral interpretations and elaborations. So it's not that they can deny in principle the idea of an oral tradition, but they don't accept this particular oral tradition. They have their own. And if you think about it, language itself, the meaning of words, is only known by oral tradition, because there's a limit to what a writing can communicate. How do you know, for example, that in English, this is a table? Basically, you know, language, the meanings of words, how do we know that Bereshit means beginning? How do I know that mitzvah means commandments? The ultimate meanings of words are in themselves recorded only by oral transmission, and therefore it's not a foreign idea that we have a Torah Shebaal Peh. So we have Torah Shebiktav, Torah Shebaal Peh. Why did God, as it were, leave large components of the Torah oral? And indeed, keep in mind, there was a law until a time in which it was abrogated for reasons I'll discuss shortly. There was a law that the oral tradition could not be in writing. It had to remain oral. Why do we have the Torah Shebaal Peh? There are really two reasons. Number one is that God wanted to ensure that the transmission of Judaism would occur through interpersonal interaction. You see, if everything is written down, in fact, some say that's the problem we face today. As wonderful as translations are, you know, everything is translated. Art Scroll and all sorts of other people. And as important and as wonderful as that is, there is a certain drawback. Because now we face the problem of people becoming self-educated, which is fine, but to the exclusion of interaction with Torah leaders and Torah figures. And there's a lot that can be communicated through interpersonal relations that cannot come through the cold, printed, or written word. There's an emotional dimension of Torah. There's a spiritual dimension of Torah. There's a sense of being part of a chain of the Jewish people that goes all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And this is kind of lost when the Torah becomes a purely academic discipline. So God wanted to ensure that you can't get it from a book. Today, the situation has changed somewhat, and I'll discuss that. But the original concept was the book would only have a limited amount of information, and you need to hear it from somebody else and ask your question. Because remember, when you're sitting there reading a book, well, on one hand, there's an advantage. You can stop and think, right? Which is, you know, that's an advantage, certainly. On the other hand, who are you going to ask your questions to? The printed page doesn't answer. Now we have interactive videos, but perhaps that would be considered to be similar to a teacher, although not entirely. But certainly the cold book itself has limitations. A second reason is maybe of lesser importance, and that is to preserve the integrity of tradition from non-Jewish or foreign influences. Let's take the Bible. The Bible, which is the written Torah, of course, is totally accessible to all cultures, all traditions, and people can put their own spins and their own glosses on it. When the Talmudic tradition was not written down, it was not accessible to the non-initiate, and hence was relatively freer from corruptive influences and the like. Okay, so whatever the reason, we do have this concept of Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, as your very excellent point noted, the Torah Shebaal Peh, or the oral law, has a variety of components, and it's important to separate them out. According to Rambam is Maimonides, who was the great expositor of what is the Torah Shebaal Peh. He divided the Torah Shebaal Peh, the entire corpus of the oral tradition, into six components. And it's a good sense, it's a good idea to get to know what these six components are. Component number one, which is relatively the smallest of these components, is what we call Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Laws that were given directly to Moshe on Mount Sinai. These are not explanations, commentaries, etc. These are direct laws, unambiguous directives that were given to Moshe B'Sinai. To take two examples, going back to tefillin, how do we know tefillin are supposed to be square? How do we know they're supposed to be black? How do we know they're supposed to be leather? These are simply halachot. These are oral interpretations that God gave to Moses that were handed down generation to generation. Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Obviously, when you open up a page of Gemara and you see argument after argument, the arguments will not be in this category. This category is a direct fixed category for which there'll be no machlokas. Okay. Yeah, I should say that. Actually, the Rambam divides this category into two. In other words, this has a 1A and a 1B, we'll say. Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. Sometimes the Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai is freestanding. Freestanding means it has no support in the biblical text. It's a totally extraneous interpretation that cannot be seen or hinted at in the words of the written Torah. For example, tefillin being black is not hinted at in the words of the written Torah. It's a pure Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. And then there's a 1B where the Rambam says it's Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, but God alludes to it or hints to it in the text of the written law. An example of that would be an esrog. The Torah says on Sukkos we take an esrog, a pre-Eitz Hadar, the fruit of a beautiful tree. How do we know what it is? And we say that it's an esrog And one of the reasons that we say it's an esrog is because we have a play on words. Hadar, which is hey, dalet, resh, means beautiful. But that doesn't tell you esrog yet. But it could also be read as a verb. Hador, that which lives on its tree year after year. Unlike other fruits, when they get ripe, they fall off the tree. An esrog is a fruit that can stay on forever and ever and ever. In fact, you can have an esrog get as big as a watermelon, in point of fact, if you just leave it on the tree. So we have a play on words. Hador, that which lives on the tree continuously. Hador. But the Rambam says it's not that the rabbis think of this play in words and they invent, you know, esrog is the one that fits. Obviously, before somebody came up with that, we knew what an esrog was, halacha l'moshe m'sinai, but once we know the law, we then go and we find hints and allusions in the written law to this. In other words, what you're doing here is, the allusion is not the source of the law. The source of the law was an unbroken transmission. But the allusion is an after-the-fact looking in the written law to see the secrets of God and how God, as it were, encoded many possibilities in the written law. So this is 1A and 1B, halacha l'moshe m'sinai. Category number two is what we call drasha. Drasha is the word for rabbinical interpretation. This is when rabbis, and I'll discuss which rabbis, it certainly doesn't mean, you know, the average rabbi in the world, but it means when rabbis look at the biblical text and they apply canons of interpretation to infer laws from the biblical text. Now, what type of canons of interpretation do we have? Well, there are different lists that were given. The most famous list is the list that we say in the morning davening. Rabbi Yishmael says the Torah is interpreted with 13 principles of interpretation. Now it's important to differentiate between 1B and 2. 1B is when we know the law ahead of time. It's halacha l'moshe m'sinai. Is that 1B or 1A? I think, yeah.
1A. No, 1B.
1B. Yeah, 1B is what I said. As we know the law, then we look in the written text and we find an after-the-fact support. That's one thing. Now we're looking at the process of discovering new laws, new principles, by utilization of rabbinic interpretation of the Torah. That's called drasha. Now, just to go, I don't want to go over all 13 of the principles, but let me give you a few of the examples. Principle number one is called a kal v'chomer. Kal v'chomer, in legal reasoning, is called an a fortiori reasoning. Kal v'chomer in Hebrew simply means a lenient and a severe, and it basically says like this. If the Torah applies a stringency in an area that's logically more permissive, the stringency should certainly apply in an area which by nature should be stricter. The example of the kal v'chomer is one the Torah itself uses. If you remember when Miriam, Moshe Rabbeinu's sister, spoke evil about her brother Moshe, so she was stricken with leprosy. And the question was, what do you do with a person who's stricken with leprosy? So God said the following. If her father would have humiliated her, if her father would have spit in her face, would she not have gone into seclusion for 7 days because of the shame? How much more so, therefore, should she do so if God has, as it were, punished her? In other words, kal, what a parent does to you is lenient compared to what God does to you. So if you got to go in 7 days, if your parent did something to you, certainly God. Or to say, for example, if I could score, if I could score a home run against a certain pitcher, then certainly how much more so could a professional baseball player score a home run against that same pitcher, right? Because that person is better than me. That's the idea of kal v'chomer. So kal v'chomer, in other words, so if the Torah, for example, gives you a law in one context, and you want to extend the law to another context, we could say, well, if that other context is a more stricter context generally, it should certainly have that. Or conversely, if the Torah gave you a dispensation in an area which normally should be stricter, and I don't know what the law is in a case which normally should be more lenient, I could use the methodology of kal v'chomer to extend leniencies. Right? So the kal v'chomer can extend a leniency to another area, or it can extend a stringency to another area. Okay? That's the idea of kal v'chomer. Gezeirus, now of course, Kal v'chomer is basically a logical type of limud. It doesn't really depend on, of course you have to know exactly how do you identify what is stringent and what is lenient, but it is something that is based on seicha, on straight logic. Gezeirus shava is not so much based on logic, it's based on more received tradition. And Gezeirus shava is similarity of wording. And that is, if the Torah uses the same word in two discrete contexts, we are permitted, as it were, to say whatever laws apply in case A also apply in case B because the words that are used are the same. Let me give you an example. I'm trying to think of a relatively simple example. I'll give you a good example. We know that one of the ways a person gets married, one of the ways you marry a woman is by giving her an object of value. Right? In fact, a wedding ring is simply an object of value. Technically, it doesn't have to be a ring. It could be a money. It could be a piece of jewelry. It could be a pen. As long as it's worth a penny. And in fact, you'll notice that religious weddings, when there have to be witnesses who see the ceremony, the rabbi will show the witnesses the ring and say, in your judgment, do you think this is worth a penny? And the witnesses have to certify, yes, we think it's worth a penny. Because that question has to be asked. Well, how do you know that marriage occurs by a husband giving the wife some object of value? The Torah doesn't say. The Torah just says, man marries woman. Doesn't say how. The answer is that the word that is used in the context of marriage is ki yikach, when a man takes a woman for him. And a similar word of kicha, taking, is used when Avraham bought the field to bury his wife Sarah. And since the word kach, taking, is used by marriage, and the word kach, taking, is used by a field, the second principle called gezeirah shava tells us that just as in the case of a field, money is the medium of acquisition, so too in the case of a marriage, money or money's value is a medium of acquisition. That similarity of wording. Now, from our limited perspective, that does not seem like an inherently logical principle. The Kal v'chomer is based on logic here. That's like saying, because I used the word give today and I used it tomorrow in two different conversations, therefore the conversations are supposed to be intermingled. But that might be true insofar as human speech is concerned. But since the written Torah, as it were, are God's own words, the notion is that if God used the same word in two different contexts, he wanted those contexts to be compared. However, Gezeirah Shavah, you can't do on your own, simply because sometimes words are used similarly which are not meant to be compared. So Gezeirah Shavah is kind of a strange thing. The Gemara tells us that nobody can do their own Gezeirah Shavah. You have to have a tradition, as it were. Unlike the Kal v'chomer, which can be done in every generation, the Gezeirah Shavah was limited to the fixed numbers that are recorded in the Talmud. Okay. And then we have other rules in the 13 principles. I'm going to go over all of them. For example, we define ambiguous terms by the context, right? A very good example would be, let's assume that you hear me say the word pair. Now, you don't know when I say the word pair, do I mean P-A-I-R, which is two things? Do I mean P-E-A-R, which is a fruit? Or do I mean P-A-R-E, which is to cut, to pair, to peel something. And how do you know? Well, one of the ways you know is you look at the context of an overall sentence to see what a word means, and that is called davar halameid miinyano. We learn meanings of words from contexts. A good example of that is in the Ten Commandments. This is an interesting thing that a lot of people aren't aware of. The Ten Commandments say, do not steal. But did you know that when the Ten Commandments say, do not steal, they are not referring to taking property. They are referring to kidnapping. Do not steal in the Ten Commandments means do not steal a person. Do not kidnap. How do we know that? And the answer is because we have to look at the context in which lo tignov appears. It says, lo tirtzach, do not murder. Lo tinaf, do not commit adultery. Lo tignov, do not steal. And we say, well, just like murdering and adultery are offenses against a person, they are physically injuring a person, so too, do not steal is an offense against the person rather than an offense against the property. So that's a davar l'hava meid minyano. Now, here. Yes, I'm sorry.
If I steal money, I don't get punished?
No, okay. I don't want to be confused. See, the Torah talks about not stealing in many, many places in the Torah. So just because, when I said it's not in the Ten Commandments, I didn't mean to say it's not in the Torah. It is in the Torah, but it's not in that particular verse. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, now, this whole idea of rabbinic interpretation of the written text is called drasha, or it's called midrash. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the body of literature called midrash. Midrash is a name of a specialized book, but midrash essentially means exposition, interpretation. Or lidrosh means to seek out the meaning of something. Right? If I'm looking for you, lidrosh, ani doresh et, I am looking for somebody. That is the process of investigation. Now here, you're in fact going to have many arguments. This is an area of the Talmud which is full of machloket, because let me explain what's going on here. Component number two is what we might call the creative aspect of the oral law. Because unlike components number 1a and 1b, which are direct laws that were given to Moshe Basina, component number 2 is when the rabbis of the Talmud are confronted with new situations, a new sheila, a new problem for which they had not received explicit guidance before. And they have to apply the canons of interpretation to try to figure out a solution. Well, obviously, when people are applying canons of interpretation, they will come up with different types of answers. And that is one of the origins of what we call machloket, of arguments. You will not have argument, the Rambam says, in categories 1a and 1b, because those are laws that God directly gave to Moshe Basina. Right? If there's an unbroken transmission, there cannot be arguments. But in category number 2, you will find in every page of the Talmud some aspect of argument. Now, here you see the inherent complexity of the notion that the oral law was given to Moshe Basina, because how do I reconcile the idea that the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh, was given to Moshe Basinai and handed down generation to generation, with the idea that the Chachamim, the wise people, look at the Torah with these canons of interpretation and come up with argument? So the answer is this. In this context, what it means is the following. The canons of interpretation themselves, the methodologies of interpretation, were divinely given. God told Moshe, these are the keys through which you unlock the secrets of the Torah. But the utilization of the keys, I give you keys, but using the keys and the conclusions you draw from those keys, there that could be a difference. The Chachamim in every generation apply those keys and may come up with different answers. So it's not the specific answer that was given to Moshe Basina, at least in this second context, but rather it's the methodology which enables the Chachamim to unlock the secrets of the Torah. And that's why, we could say, for example, the Talmud says the remarkable statement that if you have an argument and one person says A and one person says B, both of them are the words of God. Both of them are right. Obviously, in practice, we have to adopt one view. But the reason both of them are right is because as long as the proper methodology was followed, then whatever the solution, that is consistent with the ratzon, with the will of God. Because you followed the methodology that God himself has laid down. And the Rambam also makes the point that laws that are learnt out of drasha, even though they are because of rabbinic interpretation, are considered to be Torah laws, not rabbinic laws, because they are rabbinic interpretation of the Torah, and therefore they are classified as the same sanctity as the Torah law itself. It is not a rabbinic law, it is a Torah law, even though it was derived by rabbinic interpretation. Okay. A fourth component of the oral law. I numbered it differently in my sheet of paper, but you're correct. The third component of the oral law, and this is the one that is going to be the subject matter of this course, 9 out of 10 times, the use of logic analogy and generalization. In applying pre-existing laws to new situations. Again, halacha l'moshe mi-sinai, which is my category 1A and 1B, that's a finite number. By Torah I mean written law, oral law, halacha l'moshe mi-sinai. In other words, all of the components have to be applied to new situations as they find us.
I'm a little confused. What you're calling category 2, I believe, drash, right? That's aside from takanot and gezeirot, right?
Yes, that's my next thing, right.
And drash was done by the Amorim, right, in the Gemara?
No, not as a creative thing. Sometimes, the only time the Amorim did any drasha was if the Mishnah said a law and did not give a derivation. So they're trying to read back into an old law. But Jerash as a creator of new halacha did not exist in the time of the Amorim.
Only in the time of the Sanhedrin. Can you give me a good
example? Of something like that? There are really numerous examples. An example would be, for example, the ayin tachas ayin, the eye for an eye, which we interpret by drash to mean compensation.
Yeah.
But many would say that's halacha l'moshe mi-sinai, so that's not that may fall into my first category. There are examples that come to me, but they're very limited in scope. Let me try to think of a more encompassing example. Okay, an example escapes me. I mean, there are drashot that Rashi brings in Chumash at the beginning of the book of Vayikra regarding various laws that apply to offerings. And we say, I'll give you a good example. It says, honor your father and mother. Kabeit es avicha v'esimacha. Now, the word es, which is used as before a direct object, is always superfluous in effect. Because it could say kabeit avicha.
Right.
So we have a drasha that says S means you should honor along with your father, your older brother.
Right.
That's a drasha. That's a drasha that appears from the Tanoim in the Braisa.
Well, why is that considered a level of Moshe Mishina?
Well, it could be, but it's not designated as a level of Moshe Mishina.
Right. So what, in other words, what defines something as not being a level of Moshe Mishina and being a drasha?
The definition of a drash simply is this, where the law was not directly transmitted to Moshe, but was derived by the rabbis by application of a canon of interpretation.
So you're saying that before that, Bnei Yisrael didn't have the halakha?
That's correct. That is correct.
Really?
That is correct. That is correct. Now, some dispute that. There are some that take the approach that would make drash indistinguishable with halakha Moshe Mishina. They say every drash is just confirmation of an existing law within the Jewish people.
Like what the Gemara does with the Mishnah.
That's correct. But I believe that according to the Rambam in the commentary to the Mishnah, he looks at Jerash as creation of halacha, and the intimation is that prior to somebody making that Jerash, the halacha didn't exist. It came into existence as a result of that. It's fascinating, but the point is that's the intriguing idea of something given to God, given to Moses from God in terms of canons of interpretation, but the actual halacha was created.
And you're saying that period was only this period of Sanhedrin?
Yes.
Which was
yes. The period of Sanhedrin dated all the way back from Moshe was the first Sanhedrin, to around the destruction of the second temple, till the Roman period. The period of the Mishnah, more or less. A little bit after the Mishnah.
Can you just say something? Could you say something about what the head is, the thinking is behind that? That Sanhedrin would be coming up with new law?
Okay. The legitimation of the Sanhedrin coming up with new law is in the Torah itself. The Torah itself says in Parshas Shoftim, in the book of Devarim, Al pi haTorah asher yeruchah, according to the Torah, as they will instruct you, so shall you listen. And this is taken to mean not only in terms of their interpretations and the like, but they have a koach of drasha. This is considered to be a koach, a power of drasha that was given to them by the Torah itself. again, the 13 principles.
What I'm asking, is why would, because people say that, like, for instance, when the Zohar was revealed, for instance, you know. But I'm asking this: is why would it be in God's scheme of things that these particular revelations of God, God's will, would be revealed by the Sanhedrin and not at Sinai?
Yeah, an excellent point. I think the answer would be that God wanted human beings to be partners with Him in the revelation of divine wisdom. As it were, God did not want the Torah to be totally a product of heaven, but because we are in the image of God, part of our job, as it were, is to reveal Torah as well. And Drash is one of the mechanisms by which we become partners with God in the revelation of divine truth. And of course, in my third component, that's obviously the case as well, logic, and we are extending God's Torah. We're not extending, we are applying God's Torah to new situations. This is all a part of the person being a partner with God. It's a very interesting point. Actually, there is an enigmatic passage in the Jerusalem Talmud that says that the first commandments, the first tablets that God gave Moses, that he had smashed because of the golden calf, there was no oral law there. Everything was written down. It wasn't just 10 commandments. The whole business was written down. And only after the sin of the golden calf was there the dichotomy where a lot of it was left out. A lot of it was left for us to discover. A lot of it was left to the Chachamim to make drasha. Because the concept was, after the Chet HaEgel, we were no longer totally deserving. Chet HaEgel is the sin of the golden calf. We were no longer totally deserving of an unlimited revelation of God. And we have to struggle for things. And the drasha is part of our struggle, as it were, to uncover the divinity that we lost because of the sin of the golden calf. Now, when you ask me, why don't we go to specific laws? Why was this law, halacha mishnah, and that law left to be uncovered? That I can't really answer you. But the notion that some of it was left to be uncovered later, I think that's based on both the idea of the creative partnership with God and the descent that we suffered as a result of the sin of the golden calf.
Is there anywhere a list of those laws that are drash?
Well, no, because the list is... There is a list. The Rambam lists the laws that halacha lemoshe misina, and he comes up with a list of less than 50. So it's kind of, you know, you start off with 10 million laws in the Gemara learned out of Pesukim, and you subtract the 50, which are halacha lemoshe misina, and you're left with 9,950. In other words, the list is so much greater than those which are halacha lemoshe misina, that in fact they're listed the other way. The halacha lemoshe misina is listed, and not the drash.
So you're saying the drash is beyond the 613?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The 613 are the written commandments in the oral law, but within each one there are many, many laws which are based on drash. They are pratim, they are details under the 613. Well, for example, let's take the example about honoring your older brother. That's not counted as a separate mitzvah, but within the mitzvah of honoring parents is included a drash of honoring your older brother. And for each one of these 613, you can have 50 or 60 or 70 drashot. Okay. But the third category, which is what we're going to be concerned with here, deals with the use of logic and analogy in applying all of this mass of law to new situations. For example, going back to an example I used before, the Torah does say you're not supposed to light fire on Shabbos. That it does say. Okay? So it's clear I can't light a fire. But how does this apply to electricity? Is turning on an electric light a fire? It's a question. Obviously, to answer these types of questions, and you know, today we have more or less answers, although they're not always definitive, the posek, the rabbinical authority, has to have two different things that he's mastered. He's had to have mastered the Torah sources on what is fire, etc. When I say Torah, of course, I mean Talmud, Mishnah, everything else, all those sources. But in addition, the person has to have a very good grasp of science and technology. You see? Because if I know everything in the Talmud about fire, but I don't know what electricity is, I don't know how electricity works, I'm not able to compare what I know with the reality that I'm supposed to address. And that is why in the halachic process, there might sometimes be breakdowns. You might have a tremendously gifted scholar in the area of Jewish law, but he might be totally ignorant as to the technology involved. So the posek, the expert rabbinic decider, will always be in consultation with experts in any particular scientific field to be sure that he's getting the right information upon which the decision can be based. Yes.
Doesn't that draw into question the validity of many of the interpretations that were done at a time when the science was not so well understood? Certain things, I mean, certain things were interpreted during the Middle Ages, where the limits of science science knowledge was so limited.
Right. Well, that is conceivably possible, but you have to be very, very careful to identify things. That a lot of the rulings and a lot of the halakhic decision making still rests on principles that continue to be binding. The fact that they may have been applied based on ignorance of technology does not detract from the underlying principle itself. In other words, the Rambam didn't talk about electricity.
Right?
So how the Rambam would have viewed electricity is not particularly an issue that we have to face.
I guess my point is I'm not saying that this is the case, but let us say that the understanding of electricity was more limited than it should have been at the time when the Pusuk said, no, an electric light is like fire. So we can't light it on Shabbos. But if he knew now what we know about electricity, he might say, that filament is not being consumed. It's really not fire. Why not use lights on Shabbos?
Okay, you're not dealing with the Torah. The Torah did not say don't use electricity. But you're dealing, in other words, let's say 100 years ago. 100 years ago, the rabbis were first asked, are you allowed to turn on an electric light on Shabbos? Right? That was a question 100 years ago. And I think you are correct. Some of the very early tshuvot on electricity, the response on electricity, were in fact based on false premises, and the later rabbinical authorities basically discarded some of them. That is correct. That when you're dealing with a recent phenomenon, a recently discovered phenomenon, it is fairly common for there to be a lot of debate and discussion among rabbinic authorities until a consensus emerges as to how this should be treated based on understanding. In other words, it's understood that those types of decisions are tentative. It's not that the first rabbi that has ever asked a she'ela about electricity issues a ruling that is binding after the fact forever and ever. It's understood when these new things come up, there's going to be an extended period of give and take until something emerges. And you're correct. In electricity itself, various interpretations emerge. But then keep in mind this. Keep in mind that it's true that a filament does not get consumed, just like gas or oil gets consumed. But that doesn't necessarily answer the question, because we still have to identify under total framework how these situations would be covered. Okay. Two more components of the oral law. These first three components, halacha l'moshe misinai, drash, or midrash, and this last category is called savora. Savora is the Aramaic word for logic. Savora. All of these do have the status of Torah law, because whether we have received a direct answer from God, whether we use canons of interpretation, whether we use human logic in applying that, that has the status of d'oraita. D'oraita is Torah law. There are two other categories which are more legislative in nature. If you're familiar with the American legal system, you know that Congress passes laws, they legislate, and courts are supposed to interpret laws. Well, the first three categories involve either transmission of law, the creation of law through drash, or, which is really a form of interpretation, or interpreting the laws by logic. But 5 and 6 are rabbinical legislation, when the rabbis are given the authority to pass new laws. Literally, they pass new laws. Now here, we're not dealing with the Torah anymore. We're dealing with the Torah authorizes the rabbis, the Sanhedrin primarily, this is also presented, to pass new laws. And these two new laws, two categories are takanos, or Sfardit we say takanot, and gezerot, or gezeros. They're more or less a very similar concept. A gezerah is when the rabbis make a fence around the Torah. They say, don't do X, which you're allowed to do, Because you might come to do Y, which you're not allowed to do. Very, very common, making a fence around the Torah. Let me give you an example of that. We know that on Shabbat we don't handle certain objects. We don't handle money. We don't handle pens. The things we don't handle are called muktzah. Now, under Torah law, there's nothing wrong in my house to pick up money or handle a pen. I'm not allowed to write. That's a malacha. But I'm allowed to pick up a pen and move it. But kind of the rabbis basically said, don't handle the objects that you might come to do something forbidden with, because if you're starting picking up your pen, you might inadvertently sign a check. So that's kind of a fence. Go beyond the letter of the law so you shouldn't overstep your boundary. Or eating meat and milk. Under Torah law, I'm allowed to have chicken and milk. I just can't have meat and milk. Chicken is not considered meat. But rabbinically, they said, better not get, people get mixed up. If somebody sees you eating chicken, they'll think they can have a cheeseburger, therefore, let's not do it. That is called building a fence around the Torah, and that is in Hebrew called a gezeira. A gezeira means a decree. The other type of rabbinic legislation is takana. Takana is a positive enactment that is designed to either improve society or to commemorate a special occasion. Actually, very good examples are lighting Hanukkah candles to commemorate the miracle of Hanukkah. That's a rabbinic decree. The Torah didn't say light Hanukkah candles. After all, there wasn't the Hanukkah in those days. Reading the Megillah on Purim is a takana. Washing your hands before you eat bread is a takana. Reciting blessings before you eat, because the Torah says you have to recite a blessing after you eat. But before you eat is a takana. The rabbi said, be grateful to God before you eat. There are various laws. Well, we'll talk about the environment. In Yerushalayim itself, you know, there are laws that you're not supposed to operate furnaces or kilns in Yerushalayim because they didn't want the air to be polluted by smoke. The Torah doesn't say it, but the rabbis were very concerned with the aesthetic beauty of Yerushalayim and not to corrupt it with air and smoke pollution. These are takanot. But the point of these are that gezeirot and takanot are not in the Torah. They're not Torah laws. They are rabbinic legislation. Do you have to listen to them? Yes, you do. In fact, the Rambam says, anyone who transgresses a rabbinic law has also violated a Torah law, because the Torah says you shall not depart from what they say. However, to some degrees there are leniencies. For example, if one is in doubt whether one has obeyed a Torah law or not, one must be strict. If one is in doubt whether they obeyed a rabbinic law, they can be lenient. Example, if I ate bread and I forgot, I don't remember if I recited the benching or not, and 72 minutes have not yet elapsed, if I don't remember, I have to bench again, because that's a Torah requirement, and if you're in doubt, you got to do it again. If, however, I began eating and I don't remember if I recited Hamotzi or not, I do not recite Hamotzi, because that's rabbinic. If it's rabbinic, if you're in doubt, you don't have to do it. Okay? So there are differences, but fundamentally, please don't walk away with the impression that you don't have to obey rabbinic legislation. You certainly do have to obey, but it's lenient in certain regards, and especially in these halachas, we're going to see as we go through it, that occasionally, when rabbinic laws are at stake, we are permitted to adopt a more lenient approach towards their interpretation. What time do we have? Okay, so for today, what we basically covered...
A little bit less than time, so it's about 11:30.
Okay, so I have another another 2 minutes, I'll let you out, I just want to finish. So basically, what we looked at today, and we'll look a little more tomorrow before we start our main area, is we looked at what the Rambam has identified as the five components of this mass of information that we call the Torah Shebal Peh. We have Halakha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, the direct transmissions, which are either scripturally supported or not. We have the idea of Drasha. Keep in mind that Drasha is a power that we no longer have today, nor do we have the power of Takana or Gezeira. This is rabbinic legislation. What we do today, what we still have to do today, is we still have to struggle to apply through generalization and logic the dictates of the other components of the oral law to the new situations that we constantly face. Now, all of these components, Halakha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, Drasha, Savora, okay, Savora is logic, Takana, Gezeira, these five components, in the course of time have been embodied in specific literary works, such as the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, and I'll discuss what those works are, and those are the works from which we get all this information. But collectively, even before they appeared in any books, collectively the corpus was the Torah, Shebal Peh, the oral law. Today it's somewhat of a misnomer, right? Because most of the oral law can in fact be found in books. We'll discuss when that happens, and we'll also discuss why it's still called the oral law. Okay, so see you later.
Kabbalah is not considered the oral law.